Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with today's Wall Street Journal. Here are today's business headlines. Shell in early talks to acquire rival BP. Madison Avenue lands a bigger role in Hollywood. Tesla's robotaxi launch shows Google's Waymo is worth more than $45 billion. China is still choking exports of rare earths despite pact with U.S. Can Brad Pitt's FI movie finally deliver Apple's big screen hit? Bezos and Blue Origin try to capitalize on Trump-Musk split. Home Depot bid kicks off battle for $5 billion building products company. Nippon to close U.S. steel deal after national security pact with Trump. KKR making competing bid for equipment maker Spectris. UK's Reynolds agrees to $254 million private equity takeover by MPE Bidco. The first article I'll read today is Shell in early talks to acquire rival BP. A deal would be a landmark combination of two super major oil companies. Shell dismisses the journal's report as market speculation. By Ben Dummett, Lauren Thomas, and Jenny Strasberg. Shell is holding early stage talks to acquire rival BP in what would be the largest oil deal in a generation, people familiar with the matter said. Talks between company representatives are active, the people said, and BP is considering the approach carefully. Acquiring BP would put Shell on firmer footing to challenge larger competitors such as ExxonMobil and Chevron. It would be a landmark combination of two so-called supermajor oil companies, a group of multinational behemoths that dominate the production of the world's most important energy sources. Potential terms of any deal couldn't be learned, and a tie-up is far from certain, the people familiar with the matter warned. Bankers working on behalf of the companies have engaged in the discussions, which are moving slowly. Shell said, after Wall Street Journal reported of the talks, that the report is further market speculation. No talks are taking place. U.S.-listed shares in BP jumped Wednesday before easing back after Shell's comment. Under UK takeover rules, a London-listed company that issues a formal stock exchange denial of takeover talks can be prevented from approaching the target for at least 6 months. Shell released a formal statement of early Thursday, which said the company would be bound by such restrictions not to make an offer for BP except under certain circumstances, such as with the agreement of the BP board. BP spokesman declined to comment. BP is currently valued at around $80 billion. Taking into account a premium, a deal could end up as the largest corporation oil deal since the $83 billion mega merger that created ExxonMobil at the turn of the century. It would also easily be the biggest M&A deal of the year so far, in a market that has been rattled by President Trump's trade war and other geopolitical tensions. Shell comes to the talks operating from a position of strength, with its stock sharply outperforming BP in recent years. Shell, which like BP is based in the UK, but has operations around the world, has a market value of more than $200 billion. BP has been the laggard among major oil companies after an ill-fated push away from fossil fuels into renewable energy. It has also suffered years of management upheaval and operational disasters. Activist investors Elliott Investment Management, which owns more than 5% of BP's shares, has pushed for changes at the energy company since at least February, underscoring the oil and gas producers' exposure to a potential takeover bid from a rival. BP has since adopted several measures to try to address investor frustrations. It announced plans earlier this year to boost oil and gas production and sharply cut investments in clean energy. BP is also in the process of trying to sell its lubricants business that operates under the Castrol brand and has indicated it could upload at least part of its solar unit. Light Source. More recently, BP said that its chairman, Helge Hedge Fund, a key architect of the company's low-carbon strategy, plans to step down. Shell, meanwhile, has focused on its most profitable operations, pledging to pump more oil and gas and rolling back green energy targets. While asked publicly, Shell Chief Executive Officer Wael Sawan has said recently that the company's bar for big deal-making would be high. Shell in May announced a multi-billion dollar store buyback plan, the latest in a long series of big share repurchases. Shell has been working with bankers on a potential sale of its chemicals assets in Europe and the U.S., the journal previously reported. For Shell, acquiring BP would take years of integration, complicated by culture clashes and possibly the sale of overlapping assets. But a deal could give Shell's global trading business greater reach and bolster its dominance in areas like liquefied natural gas. Analysts and investors also see a good matchup in the company's operations in the Gulf of Mexico, which the U.S. now calls the Gulf of America. Acquiring BP would offer an opportunity for Shell to spread costs over a larger operating base and would box out rivals. Shell would also be more politically palatable to UK regulators who may oppose a foreign buyer from acquiring BP, a more than century-old company that traces its roots to oil exploration in Persia during the height of the British Empire. Bloomberg News reported in early May that Shell was evaluating a potential BP deal. A Shell-BP deal would be the latest in a wave of M&A activity across the energy landscape as the producers look to achieve greater economies of scale. Chevron is still working to close its $53 billion megadeal for Hess, which has been held up due to Exxon's effort to challenge the deal's legality. Exxon, last year, closed a $60 billion deal to buy Pioneer Natural Resources. Diamondback Energy sealed a $26 billion deal for Endeavor Energy Resources to bolster its position in the premium basin. Write to Ben Dummett at ben@wsj.com, Lauren Thomas at lauren.thomas@wsj.com, and Jenny Strasberg at jenny.strasberg@wsj.com. Madison Avenue lands a bigger role in Hollywood. Marketers are pushing for their brands to appear in more movies and TV shows, and entertainment execs are adjusting the way things are done to let them in. By Katie Dighton. U.S. Bank's chief marketing officer found himself on a golf course in New Jersey last October as Adam Sandler and other famous actors and golfers played their way around an entirely fictional tournament sponsored by the real-life bank. Michael LaCorazza watched as his team's suggestions for using the bank's brand in the forthcoming sequel to the 1996 comedy Happy Gilmore were put into action in ways that went beyond the typical blink-and-you'd-miss-it product placement. For this kind of showcase, U.S. Bank had paid Netflix, the movie's distributor, and worked with the streaming giant and Sandler's production company from the early stages of making the movie, fending off other interested brands to appear as a headliner sponsor in a climatic scene. We did have input in terms of how we showed up in our logos and placements, LaCorazza said. We're on the caddy bibs. We're on the tee boxes. We're in the signage. We have voice mentions in the voiceover from veteran sportscaster Vern Lundquist. Tinseltown executives and marketers have long been bedfellows. Producers for decades have worked with corporations to feature brands in movies and TV shows, and large advertisers such as Tide owner Procter & Gamble and Walmart over the years have sporadically developed their own original entertainment. Lately, Hollywood and Madison Avenue have renewed their vows for a new era. The two sides are brokering deals akin to products placement on steroids, with brands coming aboard before shooting even begins, helping finance projects early in the planning stages, and collaborating more closely with talent, distributors, and production companies. In the past 2 or 3 years, we've seen a real shift and a real commitment in behalf of big brands to take this much more seriously, said David Anderson, partner and co-head of the United Talent Agency's Entertainment Marketing Division. Before then, collaborating directly with the entertainment industry was often seen by brands more as a side project or experiment, he said. The interest has resulted in a new wave of content that treads the line between art and ad. Mattel is looking to recreate the runaway commercial success of its $101.45 billion grossing Barbie, with movies about other brands, including Hot Wheels and Matchbox. While retailer Toys R Us, last November, said it was developing a competition series. A movie about the candy company Hershey and an origin story of sorts slated for 2025 release is being produced by movie and TV production company Dandelion Media in partnership with Hershey Entities. St. Lawrence production team was a producer of last year's Oscar-winning Emilia Perez, which featured costumes from the Kering-owned fashion brand. Together, treble winners, a 2024 reality series about the soccer team Manchester City, was produced by the club's in-house production team, City Studios, under the eye of its chief marketing and fan experience officer, but lives in on Netflix under the genre of documentary. And APXGP, the fictional racing team in this summer's F1 movie from Apple Original Films, managed to rack up more than a half a dozen real sponsors, including appliance maker Shark Ninja, fashion designer Tommy Hilfiger, and software maker Expensify. In a world where consumers can ad block online, protect themselves from being tracked across the internet, and pay streamers to dodge commercials, brands are moving to embed themselves into content audiences are actually choosing to watch. Marketers that once spent portions of their budgets making videos that racked up negligible amounts of views on platforms such as YouTube are now lining up to work with entertainment professionals and co-create or at least appear in content that doesn't look like advertising on the surface. Hollywood, meanwhile, has become more welcoming to marketing dollars as it seeks to ease the cost pressures of making content. Streaming companies are leading the charge as they clamor for marketing dollars by differentiating themselves from the old ways of doing business. UTA's Anderson said, "Getting integrated marketing deals done, however, is still a messy business as brands, studios, producers, talent, and distributors all jostle over content and sign-off," he added. "We're in this immature phase where there are great examples happening," Anderson said. "I would say for every great example, there are probably 10 really good ideas that died because people couldn't figure out how to make it all work." There is also some concern that Hollywood Madison Avenue industrial complex is in danger of jumping the shark with audiences and leading collaborators down dark and expensive paths. Some marketers have become fixated on developing the next Barbie with little understanding of why it worked or how difficult the movie-making process can be, advertising executives said. The obsession was fictionalized in Apple TV's The Studio, a Hollywood satire in which Seth Rogen's studio head character is pressured into creating a movie about the Kool-Aid Man. The project is so overtly commercial that almost every attempt at moving it forward descends into chaos. Kool-Aid owner Kraft Heinz said it wasn't involved in the production of The Studio. New companies and teams are being formed to make sure that doesn't happen in reality. Startups such as Superconductor Studios and Baby Teeth have in the past few years sprung up alongside brands and ad agencies, entertainment units, promising to help marketers navigate the world of entertainment. Shortly after introducing its ads business in 2022, Netflix set up an integrated marketing team, which is responsible for looping brands into its series and movies. The streaming giant has since facilitated partnerships with the likes of Google and Emily in Paris, and language learning app Duolingo and Squid Game. Hollywood actors are also setting up their own advertising companies with gusto, selling budget holders on their connections and knowledge of what makes entertainment marketing work with audiences. Industry snobbery that once discouraged talent from working with brands and appearing in paid-for content has largely disintegrated, said actor and ad agency owner Ryan Reynolds. It used to be such that movie stars would go to Japan to do commercials, but then social media broke down barriers, he said. Certain people, in show business at least, like to maintain a mystique or a mystery, and I think that's great. But also, sometimes, you want to have a connection. Write to Katie Deighton at katie.deighton@wsj.com. All the Hollywood action is happening everywhere but in Hollywood. As in New York and Silicon Valley, jobs in Los Angeles's core industry are moving elsewhere in search of lower costs and incentives. By Craig Ipp. Los Angeles. If budget were all that mattered, Way of the Warrior Kid, in which a former Navy SEAL helps his nephew deal with bullies, would likely have been filmed in Atlanta, Canada, Australia, or Britain. But when producer Ben Everard showed the script to Chris Pratt, the star of Guardians of the Galaxy and Parks and Recreation, Everard said he agreed to do it on one condition. You gotta shoot it in L.A. because my wife's pregnant. Everard counts that as a victory for his adopted hometown, and a warning. Increasingly, raw economics favor shooting projects somewhere else. For Los Angeles to get the nod often takes something idiosyncratic, like a star with an expectant wife. The 41-year-old Everard has made 5 of his 7 films here, and in three, it was because of the star's family. If Los Angeles County were a country, its economy would be among the world's 20 largest. But that economy is ailing. Payroll employment is 1% lower than at the end of 2019, before the pandemic. It's up 5% for the country as a whole. A big reason is the malaise in film and video production. Los Angeles County employment in motion picture and sound recording is down 10%. Since 2019, according to Labor Department data. The number of shoot days across all types of production, including feature films, television, and commercials, fell for the third straight year in 2024, according to Film LA, a nonprofit that coordinates film permitting in most of the country. California's share of global projects fell to 18% in 2023, from 23% in 2021, Film LA has found. After hearing from actor John Voight on Hollywood's plight, President Trump last month proposed his favorite solution, tariffs on foreign-made films. The idea got a tepid reception here. Hollywood prefers more generous tax incentives. Governor Gavin Newsom has proposed more than doubling California's film and television tax credit budget to $750 million annually. The industry also wants less red tape and more housing to reduce the cost of doing business here. Locals rattle off the omens. Disney's Marvel Studios makes its superhero movies near Atlanta or in the UK. Netflix just expanded a production facility in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and broke ground on a huge new complex in New Jersey. The UK, by one measure, has more square footage of soundstage than Los Angeles. There are two key reasons. First, other jurisdictions are offering more lucrative, less restrictive incentives. Second, Los Angeles, always an expensive place to do business, has become more so. Housing shortages, aggravated by wildfires in January, have made the cost of living prohibitive. Los Angeles has formidable natural advantages. With ocean, mountains, and desert within a few hours' drive, you can shoot almost any movie here, and thanks to fabulous weather, on almost any day. Everard, a former chairman of Film LA, maintains it's worth paying more for the talent pool here because the superior quality shows on the screen. But he said we're living off Hollywood's endowment. The difference in cost is now so great that other jurisdictions don't have to be as good, just good enough. The recent immigration raids and the protests that follows won't help. Disruption of law and order creates uncertainty, which is the enemy of production filmmaking, says Everard. Plus, it's irresponsible for a film to draw city resources away from emergency needs in times of crisis. Off the thoroughfare in Hollywood, editors are putting together Way of the Warrior Kid at the offices of director Joseph McGinty Nicole, who goes by McGee. The offices sit inside a studio complex that was once home to Charlie Chaplin and later Muppets creator Jim Henson. McGee ticks off the recent blows Hollywood has suffered. COVID-19, then the writer's strike in 2023, and now artificial intelligence. I feel like it's musical chairs and there's 100 people walking around, but 25 seats just got pulled. McGee, who was born in Kalamazoo, Michigan, worries Hollywood is headed the same way as Detroit. True, the major studios and streamers are all based here. The auto manufacturers are also still based in Michigan. But auto assembly has moved to right-to-work states or other countries. Like finance in New York and tech in Silicon Valley, film in Los Angeles benefits from the economics of network effects. The top actors, lawyers, agents, studio executives, and directors have to be here to work with each other. But New York and Silicon Valley are cautionary tales. In both, a prosperous top masks a shrinking middle. While Wall Street's top executives, traders, and investment bankers are still in New York, mid-tier jobs migrate to places with cheaper housing and lower taxes, such as Denver, Miami, and Dallas. The top tech firms, such as NVIDIA, Apple, and HP, are still in Silicon Valley, but they make their hardware elsewhere, predominantly Asia. Richly compensated actors, directors, and studio executives will be fine. It's the grips, camera operators, costume and set designers, makeup artists and editors, mostly middle class, being squeezed between a shrinking pool of work and the high cost of living. John Dietrich, an editor on Way of the Warrior Kid, said his wife, who also works in film, can't work abroad because they have young children. When they're not shooting much in L.A., there's less work for her, he said. So it's harder to keep our heads as much above water. L.A.'s chronic shortage of housing finds its way into the cost of film production. People in high-cost cities demand more, said Azin Khanamalik, executive director of Abundant Housing L.A., a pro-development group. We saw the same dynamic play out in the tech sector. The amount of money you needed to live in the Bay Area was so great, salaries had to be higher, so some folks packed up shop and moved to Bozeman or Austin. Producers complain that high wages are killing them, while unions say members need them to stay above water, said Adam Fowler of CVL Economics, a consulting firm specializing in the creative economy. Nobody's wrong, everybody loses. Some production staff have spent so much time in Atlanta, they moved there, lured by housing that's half as expensive as in Los Angeles. To retain a competitive advantage, McGee maintains that Los Angeles must be a nice place to visit and live. He's doing his part. Last fall, he and musician John Mayer bought the rundown Henson Complex and are spending millions to restore its Chaplin-era look and feel. As McGee shows a visitor, the historically protected facade, topped by Kermit the Frog, dressed as Charlie Chaplin, a half-naked man shuffles along the sidewalk, probably a homeless guy going to score fentanyl somewhere, McGee said. We can't keep the city clean enough to make it hospitable. That's deeply problematic. Crew members tick off the costs of producing here. $700 to use a dog on set, a building permit and structural engineer to move a wall for a better camera angle. They dropped that idea. Gasoline to power generators that cost nearly $2 a gallon more than in Georgia. Much as American tech companies are chasing subsidies and cheap labor, nurtured skilled workforces in Asia, American film companies have done the same in Europe, Canada, and Australia. We've saturated the entire world with trained professional talent, said Bruce Gillies, the producer, effectively the budget guy, on Way of the Warrior Kid. Then we left and put ourselves out of work. In animation, where physical presence is less important, California's share of production dropped from 67% in 2010 to 27% in 2023, according to a report by CVL Economics. It attributes that to foreign incentives and talent pools, such as in Canada, that built a pipeline in related skills, such as video gaming. But what if the industry and the state are chasing jobs that are doomed anyway? Last month, Google released the latest version of its AI video generator, Veo. As my colleague Joanna Stern demonstrated, you can dictate scenes into it to produce an entire show. Everard insists the public will always want human-created stories played by familiar humans, such as Pratt. Why hasn't there been a hit AI-written song yet, he asks. He might be right. But to take away jobs, AI doesn't have to be as good as what Everard, McGee, and Pratt can accomplish with a $90 million budget in Los Angeles. It only has to be good enough. Soon it may be. Write to Greg Ipp at greg.ipp@wsj.com. Tesla's robotaxi launch shows Google's Waymo is worth more than $45 billion. Waymo has last valued at just $45 billion, while autonomous technology drives most of Tesla's $1 trillion value, by Dan Gallagher. Tesla's long-awaited robotaxi service has finally hit the road, but rather than help justify the electric car maker's sky-high valuation, it really highlights how underappreciated Google parent Alphabet might be for its own, much more advanced self-driving venture. The robo-taxi service Tesla launched in Austin, Texas, last weekend, involves fewer than two dozen cars offering rides to hand-picked adults in a small area of the city between the hours of 6 a.m. and midnight. The vehicles are Tesla's Model Y SUVs, outfitted with the most robust version of the company's full self-driving software. The purpose-built Cybercab that Tesla unveiled last year isn't expected to roll off production lines until at least sometime in 2026. A small-scale launch, in other words, and not a lucrative one. Tesla is charging its initial riders only $4.20 per trip, which would barely cover the cost of the Tesla employee riding as a safety monitor in the passenger seat of the vehicles involved if that employee is making the Texas minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. And yet, robo-taxis are among the moonshots supposedly underpinning Tesla's $1.1 trillion market capitalization. That is more than the combined market cap of the world's next 20 automakers by market value, according to data from S&P Global Market Intelligence. Tesla's share price is down 19% this year, but the stock still trades around 150 times projected earnings for the next four quarters. That is far above Alphabet's multiple of 18.5 times, while Ford Motor, General Motor, Toyota, Mercedes-Benz, and Honda currently average multiples of about 7.6 times forward earnings, according to FactSet data. We have long argued that robotaxis are critical to the Tesla investment case, Tom Narayan of RBC Capital Markets wrote in a report last week. He says robotaxis alone account for about 60% of his estimated valuation of the company. Tesla has to start somewhere, but the launch also serves as a reminder of how much road remains between it and Waymo. The robotaxi service, majority owned by Alphabet, started service in Atlanta this week. That makes five cities served by a fleet of over 1,500 autonomous vehicles in total. Waymo plans to more than double that fleet by the end of next year, thanks to a new manufacturing facility in Arizona. Investors are on board. Waymo raised $5.6 billion in a late-stage funding round last year. That deal valued Waymo at $45 billion, which put it among the 10 most valuable venture-backed companies that haven't yet gone public, according to data from PitchBook. Some Wall Street analysts covering Alphabet have higher estimates now, given Waymo's strong lead in the robotaxi service market and a partnership with Uber that is expected to boost usage. Josh Beck of Raymond James put a base case valuation of Waymo around $150 billion in a report last month. He projects the company's gross bookings will average 129% growth annually for the next 5 years. That sort of blistering growth rate certainly isn't guaranteed, and the design of Tesla's service still leaves open the possibility that it could quickly catch up, since much of the company's existing fleet could be theoretically converted into revenue-generating robotaxis through a software update. That design represents a major bet by Tesla chief executives Elon Musk, who has shunned the use of self-driving systems that include the more expensive LiDAR technology that uses laser beams like radar to sense its surroundings. Tesla's autonomous system is based on cameras and software, which is cheaper to deploy, but adds potential for new problems, such as cars getting blinded by sunlight. And the company's large base of both friends and foes has given this launch unprecedented levels of scrutiny, with user-generated videos of the Tesla robotaxis flooding social platforms. Regulators are reportedly already making inquiries about instances where the cars appeared to violate local traffic laws. $1 trillion buys an awful lot of eyeballs on Tesla's stock, but investors could be missing the more obvious bargain right in front of them, Alphabet. Write to Dan Gallagher at dan.gallagher@wsj.com. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take Sun Sounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. China is still choking exports of rare earths despite pact with U.S. Western companies are struggling to secure upheavals for rare earth imports from Chinese authorities despite U.S.-China deal. By John Emmett. 2 weeks after China promised the U.S. it would ease the exports of rare earth magnets, Chinese authorities are dragging out approval of Western companies' requests for the critical components, a situation that could reignite trade tensions between Washington and Beijing. Western companies say they are receiving barely enough magnets for their factories and have little visibility of future supplies. Firms are waiting weeks as Chinese authorities scrutinize their applications, only to be rejected in some cases, and applications for rare earths, which are used to make magnets, are rarely granted. As a result, Western companies are concerned that the shortages could soon affect manufacturing. Companies are so desperate for magnets that they are opting for expensive air freight, whenever licenses are granted to prevent costly production shutdowns. Some manufacturers are experimenting with workarounds that would allow them to make their products without the most powerful magnets. It's hand-to-mouth, the normal supply chain scrambling that you have to do, said Lisa Drake, a vice president overseeing Ford's industrial planning for batteries and electric vehicles, earlier this week. Although she said the situation had improved, the scarcity of the rare earth magnets is forcing Ford to move things around to avoid factory shutdowns, she said. Manufacturers have taken the continuing challenges as a sign that new Chinese rare earth export restrictions, introduced in April after President Trump raised tariffs on China, are here to stay. Contrary to White House assertions that the flow of the critical components would return to normal. Yes, the export restrictions have been paused on paper. However, ground reality is completely different, said Nia Mekarji, a rare earths analyst at Benchmark Mineral Intelligence. The licensing process is plagued by bureaucratic drag. China's Ministry of Commerce said Thursday that it has been accelerating the review of rare earth export license applications and has approved a certain number. The restrictions illustrate the power Beijing holds through its formidable supply chains and how it can use them to inflict pain on Western businesses and exact concessions from the U.S. China makes 90% of the world's most powerful rare earth magnets, a key component in everything from cars to jet fighters. In April, after Trump heaped stiff tariffs on Chinese products, Beijing established an export control system for rare earths. While it said the license system was set up to regulate the export of materials for military use, the regime has, in effect, allowed China to clamp down on rare earth supplies as it wishes. After April, the supply of magnets to Western businesses slowed to a trickle, causing shockwaves for global car, defense, and electronics makers. Exports of rare earth magnets to the U.S. declined 93% in May from a year earlier. Ford stopped production of its Explorer SUV at its Chicago plant for a week in May. The U.S. accused China of slow-walking the approval of export licenses, which China denied. The shortage drove both sides back to the bargaining table earlier this month, where China agreed to free up the flow of rare earths in exchange for the U.S. easing its own restrictions on certain U.S. exports to China. Following the deal, Trump wrote that full magnets and any necessary rare earths will be supplied up front by China. However, China put only a six-month limit on any new licenses, the Wall Street Journal has reported. Now, in the applications for export licenses, Chinese authorities are asking Western companies for sensitive details such as contact information of those buying their magnets, and even designs of how their magnets are integrated into components like motors. Chinese authorities justify this scrutiny as necessary to ensure the magnets aren't used for military purposes, say companies involved in the magnet trade. When companies skip certain questions on their magnet applications to avoid disclosing sensitive intellectual property or details of commercial arrangements, their applications languish or are denied. In some cases, the applicants have then been told to start over and include all of the required information in a new application, which takes 45 days to process, according to companies involved in rare earth imports. The control is real, said a representative of one such company. There are thousands of applications the Chinese authorities have received. Earlier this month, Germany's main industry association called in the country's new government to push China to ease the approval process. German industry needs to be able to plan in the near term. Licensing procedures must not be used as a means of exerting political pressure, it said. Beijing also appears to be trying to prevent stockpiling by Western businesses. One Chinese magnet maker has warned clients seeking to import more magnets than usual that they may have to explain to government officials the business drivers behind such large orders, according to an advisory note the magnet maker shared with clients. Fearful of shortages, many Western businesses are complying with the information requests, but are still facing long delays. The success of their application also depends on their supplier. Big state-connected magnet companies are getting export licenses faster than smaller private ones, according to many in the industry. The export policy for magnets is still very strict, said a representative for one Chinese magnet maker. Now, some Western businesses say they are resigned to the fact that the restrictions may remain in place indefinitely. Some private Chinese magnet makers who are under significant financial pressure due to the export controls are working with clients to find workarounds. For instance, some are encouraging foreign clients to buy less powerful magnets that don't include any controlled rare earths. Some Chinese companies are also working to develop stronger magnets that don't rely on restricted materials, but swapping out the most powerful and heat-resistant magnets is often impossible for auto and electronics industries, which rely on magnets to efficiently power motors. Olive Lien, an expert in semiconductor cooling technology based in Taiwan, said many companies in recent months have been struggling to acquire rare earth magnets needed for some high-end fan motors used in products such as AI servers and other high-performance computing systems. Many companies have been forced to redesign their products, such as by switching to cheaper and more readily available ferrite magnets, which are less powerful. One U.S. magnet importer said that while two licensing applications he was involved with were recently approved, others are dragging. The system is slow and burdensome, he said, very detailed and confusing for the applicants. While automobile parts companies do get their license approved, they are paying extra to rush the magnets to factories by air, costs which are often ultimately borne by the car makers. These are the things you don't hear about. How much money it is taking to keep these factories running, you know, limping along, the magnet importer said. Write to John Emmont at jonathan.emmont@wsj.com. Trump's immigration raids in L.A. reshaped life for a long-time workforce. Region is home to one of the nation's largest and oldest Hispanic communities, which underpins the economy. By Paul Kierman and Catherine Sayre. Los Angeles, Pablo de la Parr, emigrated from Mexico 25 years ago, has five children who are U.S. citizens, aged 14 to 22, and runs a small street stand selling toys from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. He's one of the millions of immigrants who make up Greater Los Angeles' Hispanic community. Some crossed the border illegally, overstayed visas, or were brought here illegally as children, and are stuck in legal limbo. They assumed President Trump wouldn't target them for deportation and that he would instead focus on criminals and more recent arrivals. The raids that unfolded here this past week, triggering protests and Trump's deployment of National Guard and active duty troops, shattered that belief and altered life for a community that underpins the economy of the nation's second-largest metropolis. Normally bustling streets hit by immigration raids were quiet, as some families retreated into their homes, while other immigrants living here illegally ventured to work out of necessity. They say their thoughts were haunted by the possibility that they wouldn't see their families again. The immediate effect has been a fall off in business and a strain in some parts of the labor force. After several car washes around Los Angeles were hit by immigration and customs enforcement raids on Sunday and Monday, at least one remained closed for lack of workers. On Thursday, Trump posted on social media that farmers and people in the hotel and leisure business have been stating that our very aggressive policy on immigration is taking very good long-time workers away from them. The administration soon after instructed immigration officials to hold off on workplace raids of farms, restaurants, and hotels. A farm workers union said raids affecting farm workers continued even after the guidance was issued. LA officials said The raids have also targeted hospitals, schools, and homeless shelters. On a good day, Delpierre sells between $200 and $250 worth of toys and stuffed animals, mostly to other Hispanic immigrants and their families. 2 hours before closing on Tuesday, he had made $25. Delpierre said that he has been scanning the streets for any sign of federal agents and mentally prepared himself if immigration authorities arrive. "I wouldn't run because I know that running would only make things worse," Delpierre said. Experts estimate the number of immigrants who entered illegally or are living illegally in Los Angeles County at close to 1 million people, or roughly 10% of the population. Only a fraction came during the 2021 to 2024 immigration wave that brought some 12 million newcomers to the U.S. Many of them settled in Texas and Florida, where construction jobs are more plentiful and the cost of living cheaper. Several million claimed asylum or received temporary protected status, a designation for people whose home country the president deems unsafe. Los Angeles County, 58% of Hispanic non-citizens have been in the country for 21 years or more, according to 2023 census data aggregated by IPUMS at the University of Minnesota. Nationwide, the figure is 39%. Census data don't distinguish between legal and unauthorized non-citizens. Victor Naro, a project director for the Labor Center at the University of California, Los Angeles, who has worked on immigrants' rights, says people from Mexico and Central America power the local workforce. "The social fabric is devastated and destroyed because of the immigration raids," he said. "But then there's also the economics. Migrants from these regions are the dominant labor supply in residential construction, including the work being done now to rebuild the Pacific Palisades and Altadena communities after the January wildfires," he said. Naomi Kiao's husband, Jesus, is from Mexico. She was born in California. "They met as teenagers while living in the same apartment building. He was my first love," she said. Kiao said he had just finished buying their daughter an 8th grade graduation dress at TJ Maxx on Sunday when she opened Facebook on her phone and saw news of an immigration raid in their neighborhood. The photos showed the car wash where Jesus had worked for 10 years. She dropped her daughter off and sped to the car wash, where the owner informed her that Jesus had been taken. Kiao, who works in LA's airport, said she doesn't know how she will juggle work with caring for the couple's 4 children. Her husband drives them to music and dance classes and soccer practice. Historically, federal removals focused on people who had just crossed the border or those with criminal records. During the 2024 election campaign, Trump promised to carry out the largest deportation in history, suggesting criminals would be the first targets. In recent weeks, however, administration officials have vowed to deport anyone in the country without authorization. Polling earlier this year by the Wall Street Journal found that a narrow majority of Americans said they support deporting millions of undocumented immigrants. Nearly 3/4 said such a policy should target only criminals, and 79% favor creating a pathway to citizenship for immigrants who have been in the U.S. illegally for many years and pass a background check. Immigrant advocates estimated that around 300 people had been arrested in recent ICE sweeps in the Los Angeles area. A Department of Homeland Security spokeswoman shared several news releases with photos of about 24 detainees the agency said had been previously arrested, charged, or convicted of crimes ranging from child molestation to homicide. The agency said it is going after the worst of the worst. The indiscriminate nature of the operations in Los Angeles upended the conventional wisdom among undocumented immigrants that risks could be managed by working hard, driving carefully, and paying taxes. The spectacle of the arrests created a chilling effect. Kimberly and Jaslyn Hernandez, ages 25 and 17, cried and held each other at a press conference in Culver City, California. Their father, Joel Hernandez, was detained Sunday at the car wash where he had worked for at least 20 years. Natalie Ziegler, a 35-year-old nurse practitioner, told the Journal that she was sitting on a bench outside the car wash, shopping on her phone, while her 2017 Volkswagen Tiguan was being cleaned when she heard footsteps and looked up. "I see a man in full green outfit, military garb that says ICE, with a machine rifle," Ziegler said, adding that seeing the operation in her own neighborhood deeply upset her. Customer Tess Dunn, 32, said agents pointed their guns at one man as they chased him across eight lanes of traffic on Venice Boulevard, a busy thoroughfare. Douglas Galicia fled El Salvador to the U.S. in 1980 and became a naturalized citizen. For two decades, he has sold makeup as well as green baby turtles from a table facing the street in downtown L.A.'s fashion district. Galicia said he has sold $50 worth of merchandise last weekend. A normal weekend would bring in $1,500 to $2,000. He began carrying his U.S. passport after the raids. "My daughters said, 'Dad, bring your papers,'" said Galicia, 65, "who knows what might happen and the time it takes them to investigate you." Another shopkeeper, a 54-year-old woman from El Salvador, pointed to her inventory of clothing and fabrics. "There's no way I can restock what I sell because what little revenue I make has to go to rent and food," she said. The woman said she traveled by boat, car, and bus from El Salvador in 2005. She cleaned office buildings until she could afford to start her business 8 years ago. "I felt so triumphant, finally being able to work for myself without anybody else telling me what to do," she said. The thought of losing what she built makes her sad and scared, but she's willing to risk coming back to work. Her husband is an Uber driver, and her son is a cook. They're all living in the U.S. illegally. She has two grandchildren who are U.S. citizens. "I want to protect my grandkids more than anything," she said. "I tell my son, either you can go outside or their mom can go outside, but not both of you together because it's too risky." Del Pierre, the toy seller, said his wife stays home to care for his eldest son who is disabled, and the couple rely on their 21-year-old daughter, a U.S. citizen, to run errands. "The only one who risks himself is me," he said. Write to Paul Kiernan at paul.kiernan@wsj.com and Catherine Sayre at Catherine, katherine@wsj.com. And here's an opinion article by the editorial board, "The Great Medicaid Hospital Scam. Republicans can fix their provider tax scheme that fleeces taxpayers." No industry other than perhaps higher education feasts more on government than hospitals, so it's no surprise that hospitals are blaring their sirens over the GOP's effort to clamp down on the scheme they use to grab more federal Medicaid money. It's hard to think of a bigger government-sanctioned racket than Medicaid provider taxes. States pioneered these during the 1980s to obtain more federal Medicaid matching funds and reduce spending on the program from their general tax revenue. The free lunch has enabled states to expand benefits and greatly diminished the incentive to operate the program efficiently. Here's how it works. States assess taxes on health providers, namely hospitals. They then channel the revenue back into their Medicaid programs to draw more federal money. For every dollar that states spend on Medicaid, they get $1 to $3 more from the feds, and $9 for able-bodied individuals covered under Obamacare. Hospitals then receive more in Medicaid payments than they pay in the provider taxes. In 1991, George H.W. Bush signed bipartisan legislation to crack down on this scheme, which even Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer voted for. The law forbids Medicaid taxes that have the effect of holding providers harmless, as nearly every state tax today does. Even the Biden Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services in 2023 noted that providers have struck agreements to redistribute their Medicaid payments to other providers to ensure they all recoup their tax payments, including those that don't treat Medicaid patients. Is this political collusion in plain sight? Yes. As CMS explained, the redistribution enables broad support for the tax program from all hospitals. Such arrangements are legal under the 1991 law, but the Clinton administration created a regulatory safe harbor that sanctions provider taxes as long as they are assessed at a rate of less than 6% on net patient revenue. And to Republicans who are seeking to crack down on the scam, the House tax bill freezes provider taxes on current rates. The Senate finance draft would go further by reducing the safe harbor tax by 0.5% annually, starting in 2027, to 3.5% in states that have expanded Medicaid under Obamacare. Taxes would be frozen in non-expansion states. Cue the howls from the hospital lobby. Since that when does an industry protest a tax cut for itself? Hospitals claim any restrictions on the tax will cause rural hospitals to close. But they say the same about all Medicaid reforms, including work requirements. Congress can appropriate money specifically for rural hospitals if members are worried about their vitality. Medicaid often pays below the cost of care, but supplemental state payments funded by provider taxes more than compensate. Such payments made up a large share of earnings last year for profit hospitals such as Universal Health Services, Tenet, and HCA. Most hospitals are prospering. One reason that government regulations have encouraged hospitals to merge and buy physician practices, which increased their leverage with insurers since 2010, prices charged by hospitals have increased 97% compared to 31% for physicians, 42% for prescription drugs, while overall inflation has been 48%, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Medicare also pays hospitals higher rates than independent physicians for the same treatments. The federal 340B program lets hospitals buy medicines at steep discounts and charge markups to private insurers. Republicans have shrunk from targeting these undeserved hospital perks, so the least they can do is stop hospitals from their dishonest Medicaid scheme. That brings us to the end of today's edition of the Wall Street Journal. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.